CBS News Face the Nation in 60 seconds.
Squarespace makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website or online portfolio. It's the all-in-one platform that really is easy to use. Building a website is as easy as drag and drop. You can use drag and drop to add content from your desktop and even rearrange elements of content within a page. For a free trial and 10% off your first purchase, go to squarespace.com and use the offer code FACETHENATION. Every design automatically includes a unique mobile experience that matches the overall style of your website, so your content will look great on every device every time. It starts at just $8 a month and includes a free domain name if you sign up for a year. You can also use Squarespace to easily connect your new website to Twitter, Facebook, Pinterest, and many more web and social services. For the best way to build your own site quickly, go to squarespace.com, use offer code FACETHENATION. That's offer code FACETHENATION.
From CBS News in Washington, Face the Nation with Bob Schieffer.
Today on Face the Nation, breaking news on the missing plane as new satellite images are discovered, and Mitt Romney speaks out on Ukraine and American leadership. We'll get the latest on the search from our reporter on the scene and veteran pilot Sully Sullenberger. And we'll talk to Dave Gallo, who led the underwater team that found the wreckage of the Air France plane that had been lost at sea for 2 years. On Ukraine, does Vladimir Putin want more than Crimea? And if he does, what will the West do? We'll talk to Mitt Romney, who warned during the campaign about Russian intentions. And we'll hear from Democratic Senator Dick Durbin, just back from Ukraine, and Republican Senator Kelly Ayotte, who is there now. Plus, our panel of experts on those stories and the other news of the week. 60 years of news, because this is Face the Nation. Well, there is actually some new information this morning on the search for that missing Malaysian plane. New satellite images, these from the French, that show objects in the same general vicinity as the earlier satellite images. The search is now focused on an area about the size of Texas, some 1,500 miles off the coast of Perth, Australia. Our Holly Williams is in Perth this morning. Holly.
Good morning, Bob. There is now a massive search taking place in the waters of the southern Indian Ocean for what might be the wreckage of Malaysian Airlines Flight 370, which has been missing for more than 2 weeks. Yesterday, the Chinese government released a blurry satellite image showing something around 70 feet by 40 feet floating in the sea 1,500 miles off Australia's west coast. That's just 80 miles from where an Australian satellite spotted two objects last Sunday, one of them a similar size. And the Malaysian authorities said today that a French satellite has also sighted debris in the same area. The only possible human sighting so far was yesterday when the pilot of a civilian aircraft reported seeing several objects in the water, including a wooden pallet. Now, that's an item commonly used in the cargo hold of passenger planes, but also in shipping containers. Australia's Maritime Safety Authority has warned that there is no certainty, but these are the only credible leads in the search for the missing Boeing 777. Today, a fleet of military and civilian aircraft from the US, Australia and New Zealand combed a region of the Indian Ocean the size of West Virginia. In difficult weather conditions with lots of cloud cover, radar has proved ineffective. So they're relying on the human eye and they're flying just a few hundred feet over the water. It is extremely challenging work in seas that are notoriously rough. Now, more than half of the passengers on Flight 370 were from China. Several Chinese ships are making their way to the search area and two Chinese aircraft will join the operation tomorrow.
All right, Holly Williams. Thank you so much, Holly. And we are joined now by retired U.S. Air Captain Sully Sullenberger, who made that miraculous landing on the Hudson River 5 years ago. He's now a CBS News aviation and safety contributor. Sully, what do you make of this latest situation? Should we be hopeful about this, these new images that we've seen?
Well, good morning, Bob. Everyone is grasping for any bit of hope they might be able to find. This is an extraordinary circumstance in many ways. And with each passing day, it makes it more challenging because of the combined effect of wind and current on what floating debris there may be. And if it turns out that this debris is part of the airplane, which it might not, then, of course, the searchers have to work backwards for several weeks, applying, again, that wind and current information to try to find where on the ocean floor the aircraft may be, if that's where it is. Unfortunately, there were some missteps made very early on. Here we are into the third week of the investigation, and just now beginning to really narrow the search to areas that are still as large as United States states.
Well, so, you know, this information keeps coming out in dribs and drabs, obviously, because some of it we're learning, I guess, when the searchers find it. But it seems to me some sort of there's a problem with communications here. Do you sense that?
And that's not an uncommon circumstance to find in these large endeavors. There are many countries in the world where there is not sufficient coordination between the civilian air traffic control organization and the military radar air defense organizations. There is little sharing of information. And then you add to that the regional concerns, suspicion, instability, border disputes. It makes it even harder to mount large-scale investigations, large-scale searches that most of these countries can simply not do by themselves. And if one other good thing comes out of this, it would be more widespread use globally of the Interpol Stolen and Lost Travel Documents database. My understanding is currently only the United States, the United Kingdom, and the United Arab Emirates make a 100% check of passengers on that SLTD, Stolen and Lost Travel Documents database. And that's something that should be done globally to prevent people from boarding an airplane with a fraudulent travel document.
Is it possible that we're not ever going to know what happened here?
Well, unfortunately, with the passing time, with each passing hour and day, it becomes somewhat more likely that that may be the case, or it may take many years. But hopefully some floating debris will be found that will be traced back to this airplane, and then we can work backwards to find the point where it entered the water and begin doing a search on the ocean floor to bring up as much wreckage as can be found, do a forensic analysis of that, and hopefully find the digital flight data recorder and the cockpit voice recorder.
When do you think we'll reach the point where we'll stop searching?
It's unlikely that we'll reach that point soon, unless there are simply no leads to follow. As we've said, it took about 2 years for the wreckage of Air France 447 to be found in the deep waters of the South Atlantic after the 2009 crash. I think great efforts and huge sums will be expended to find this aircraft and to resolve this huge ambiguity.
If these satellite images prove to be part of the wreckage, finding what is beneath the surface is the next step. Sully, we want to thank you for being with us this morning. But finding what's beneath the surface is the next step, and there are only a few companies in the world who are able to do that. Dave Gallo, who heads up special projects for one of the best, the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute, is with us here this morning.
Thank you, Bob.
In 2011, nearly 2 years after Air France Flight 447 crashed off the coast of Brazil, the Woods Hole staff located the wreckage 2.5 miles below the surface of the Atlantic Ocean. Special underwater vehicles called REMUS 6000s map the ocean floor through a process called mowing the lawn. The same vehicles were then able to gather high-resolution photos of the jet's remains, leading to the recovery of crucial flight data and the cockpit voice recorders.
Now, Dave, you've been there before. You've done this with the Air France plane. What happens if these satellite images turn out to be wreckage? What happens next?
Well, then we put it over to a team of scientists that, using models of the shape of the various pieces of debris, can look at the currents, the winds, the waves, tides, all that stuff for the past few weeks and backtrack it. Hopefully that'll give us the X on the ocean where to begin the underwater search.
Well, I'm told we have this search area narrowed down to about the size of the state of Texas.
Yeah.
Can you start the underwater search when the search area is that big, or do you have to narrow it down?
You know, Bob, you could, but we need to have a much better haystack than that. The Air France search was a 40-mile radius circle, so it was about 5,000 square miles. We're many times that size right now. I mean, nothing's impossible, but we do need to have some real good foundation for where we begin to look beneath the sea.
Well, would you locate things beneath the sea using sonar? Is that the next step?
Sonar, yes. Almost like we'd go into that area and do something very akin to plowing a field, very detailed long lines using a sonar, identify the wreck, and then move in with higher resolution equipment.
And then when you start going underwater with your special vehicles, what happens then?
Well, then once the wreck is identified, you want to almost do a forensic analysis in place using the best cameras, the best robots. It's all the same thing. You have to have the right technology, the right team, the right game plan, and a little bit of luck, a lot of prayer, and then off you go.
I'm looking on the screen now. We're seeing some. Now, what exactly is that?
That torpedo-shaped thing you see in its launch pad, it's called a Remus 6000. It's one of the most sophisticated underwater robots on Earth. We use three of those on the Air France survey search. They cover about 25 square miles a day. So it's slow going, but the last thing you want to do is go over a spot, miss the aircraft, and then go on to the next spot.
And how far are we from that now? I mean, obviously we haven't found it.
Yeah, it's frustrating, Bob, because, you know, and I don't want to hope against the hopes and prayers of the families by hoping this is wreckage from the plane. But we're a ways away. You know, in Air France, it was a two-year process. It wasn't all spent at sea, but a lot of thinking, a lot of things going on, decide who goes and does what next. But, you know, we're at the beginning of that. Well, it's a long haul from here to there.
And what do you know about the ocean floor at this particular place, if it turns out this is where the wreckage is?
The place that it is a horrible place to do any kind of work. The waters are incredibly rough. I've spent time there in 60-mile-an-hour winds and 30-foot waves. But the seafloor beneath is relatively smooth and flat. It's an underwater volcanic mountain range, and it's much simpler to work than the Air France area.
So right now, what do you think the chances are that there is something?
I'll put it this way: you know, we're looking for some very small needles bits of a needle in a very large haystack. But if you have the confidence of the government's, confidence of the families, and again with the right team, the right technologies, nothing's impossible. So I'm confident, given those things, it's impossible to say when, because we don't know where to start and when to start.
I know you volunteered your help. Has anybody said we need you yet?
Not yet, Bob. So we're in standby mode. We've offered through the State Department and to the Malaysians directly, so we'll wait and see.
All right. Well, thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
We'll be back in a moment. To the crisis in Ukraine. This morning, the head of NATO's military command says the Russian forces who are massed at the eastern border of Ukraine are very, very sizable and very, very ready, to use his words. U.S. military estimates put the number of Russian forces at 20,000. Former Massachusetts governor and 2012 Republican presidential nominee Mitt Romney is joining us to talk about that and other news this morning from San Diego. Good morning, Governor, and welcome back to Face the Nation. During the campaign, and I want to start with this, you took a lot of heat for saying that Russia was our greatest geopolitical foe. In the third debate, the president came down pretty hard on you about that.
A few months ago, when you were asked what's the biggest geopolitical threat facing America, you said Russia. Not Al-Qaeda. You said Russia. In the 1980s, are now calling to ask for their foreign policy back because, you know, the Cold War has been over for 20 years.
I'm sure, Governor, you're tempted this morning to say, I told you so. But do you really believe that what happened in Ukraine had anything to do with what President Obama has or hasn't done?
Well, but there's no question but that the president's naivete with regards to Russia and his faulty judgment about Russia's intentions and objectives has led to a number of foreign policy challenges that we face. And unfortunately, not having anticipated Russia's intentions, the president wasn't able to shape the kinds of events that may have been able to prevent the kinds of circumstances that you're seeing in the Ukraine, as well as the things that you're seeing in Syria. We really need to understand that Russia has very different interests than ours. This is not fantasy land. This is reality where they are a geopolitical adversary. They're not our enemy, but they are certainly an adversary on the world stage.
Well, should we have known this? Should we have anticipated it? Because it caught a lot of people by surprise, it seems to me.
Well, there may have been some people surprised, but there were many, many others who predicted that Russia would try and grab additional territory. And certainly when we saw the demonstrations going on in Ukraine, and we recognized that Russia has a major base in Sebastopol in Crimea, it couldn't be a surprise to folks that Russia might take the opportunity to grab that territory. After all, we see reports saying that Russian soldiers came in without Russian insignia, that their trucks didn't have Russian insignia. This had been prepared for some time, and we certainly could have taken action early on. We would have had far more options to try and shape events to keep Russia from moving in. For instance, working with our allies around the world to develop the sanctions, communicating those to Russia very, very clearly, at the same time saying, look, we're not going to interfere with your base in Sebastopol, nor your influence in Kiev. These kinds of things had the potential of keeping Russia from making a devastating move, one that changes the whole political landscape of the entire world, and certainly that of Eastern Europe.
Well, we have put on some sanctions now. They don't seem to have done much good. You're saying if we had done it earlier, how actually would we have done that? And are the sanctions they've put on now, do we need stronger sanctions?
Well, let's step back. I think effective leaders typically are able to see the future to a certain degree and then try and take actions to shape it in some way. And that's, of course, what this president has failed to do, and his Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, as well. They thought resetting relations with Russia, handing out gifts to Russia, would somehow make Russia change its objectives. Well, that certainly wasn't the case. Had we, from the very beginning of the demonstrations in Ukraine, Ukraine, had we worked with our allies and said, look, let's talk about the kinds of severe sanctions we would put in place if Russia were to decide to move, and had we then communicated that to Russia beforehand, not put in place the sanctions, but communicate, look, Russia, stand down here. Don't you think about grabbing territory, or these are the things that will have to happen. These are the actions we will take. And by the way, Russia, we're not going to interfere with your base in Sebastopol and so forth. Had we communicated those things, there's always the potential that we could have kept them from invading a country and annexing it into their own.
So what would be your advice to the president now? What should we be doing now, and what do we do next? For example, what are we going to do if Putin decides to move those troops that he's got poised on the border into other parts of Ukraine?
Well, given the fact that there's a real potential that Russia might be thinking in that direction, we need to communicate with our allies. What actions would we take? Tell Russia before they've acted, say, look, Russia, if you do these things, these are some of the things that are going to happen. And, of course, you keep other options on the table as well. Right now, you do the kinds of things that are only available to you after something bad has happened, which options are typically far less effective. But you do put in place the sanctions. You do strengthen our relationship with our friends, particularly in Eastern Europe. You welcome those that seek entry into NATO to join NATO. You rebuild our military budget. You don't shrink our military budget at a time like this. You begin cooperation, military cooperation, with nations in Eastern Europe that want that cooperation. For instance, you reconsider putting in our missile defense system back into the Czech Republic and Poland as we had once planned. And as you recall, we pulled that out as a gift to Russia. Look, these are the kinds of actions you take, and the president is taking many of those. I'm saying what he should have done from the very beginning was have the judgment to understand that Russia was not our friend, that Russia was had very different ambitions and interests than we did, and that you have to stand strong. And by the way, the president's actions in Syria, I believe, are one of the things that led to the kind of aggressiveness you're seeing from Russia today.
Have we re-entered the Cold War?
No, we haven't entered that level of if you will, cold conflict. But we certainly recognize that Russia has very different interests than ours, that Russia is going to push against us in every possible way. They've been doing it. Look, they've blocked for many years the toughest sanctions against Iran. They stand with Assad in Syria. They stand with Kim Jong-un in North Korea. They link with some of the world's worst actors. They send a battleship into the Caribbean and into Cuba. They harbor Edward Snowden. All these things are designed to say, hey, look, we're pushing against the United States. They are our geopolitical adversary. They're not our enemy, but they're an adversary on the playing field of the world. And this is a playing field where we're going to determine whether the world is going to see freedom and economic opportunity, or whether the world is going to see authoritarianism. And Russia and Putin wants to be an authoritarian, and that's not something that the world needs or wants.
How would you judge America's place in the world right now?
Well, you look and see what's happening in the world and ask yourself, after 5 years of the Obama administration and Secretary Clinton, her administration, and now a new Secretary of State, who, by the way, I hope does well, but you look over the past 5 years and say, what's happened? Good things have not been bursting out all over. The Middle East is in turmoil. Iraq is fragile and may fall back into a devastating setting. We're not making the kind of progress in Afghanistan that had been promised. And our esteem around the world has fallen. I can't think of a major country. It's hard to think of a single country that has greater respect and admiration for America today than it did 5 years ago when Barack Obama became president. And that's a very sad, unfortunate state of affairs.
Final question, Governor. Have you been thinking, are you thinking about running for president again?
No, I'm thinking about the people who I want to see running for president. And there's quite a group. I mean, we have a very strong field of leaders who could become our nominee. And could stand up for the kind of leadership I think America wants. Look, a lot of people are looking back to the 1980s and saying, wouldn't it be nice if we had leaders like Ronald Reagan and George Bush and Jim Baker and George Shultz and some of the strong presidents and secretaries of state that led us during very difficult times. That's the kind of leadership we want. I think we have those kinds of leaders in the party, and I fully anticipate that I'll be supporting one of them very vigorously.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us and giving your thoughts on all this. Governor, it's nice to see you again.
Thanks, Bob. Good to be with you.
And later in the broadcast, Democratic Senator Dick Durbin, who's just back from Ukraine, and Republican Senator Kelly Ayotte, who's in Ukraine now. Plus, some personal thoughts from me about these two big stories. The last time I can remember two such compelling stories competing for our attention was 1997. Bill Clinton was about to make the first State of the Union speech of his second term when word came that a verdict was coming down in O.J. Simpson's civil trial. The nation was mesmerized by anything and everything O.J., and every TV newsroom confronted one question. What do we do if the verdict comes in the middle of the president's speech? Do we cut away and broadcast the verdict? Do we go to split screen with the president on one side and O.J. on the other? Fortunately, the verdict came as the president was winding down, so the networks and CNN took a deep breath, stayed with the president, then reported the verdict when the speech ended. The plane story is a tragedy of unspeakable proportion for the families and a compelling mystery for the rest of us. But our fascination with that should not lull us into underestimating the potential danger of what is unfolding in Ukraine, where some untoward, even accidental event could literally plunge the world into war. So we'll keep you posted on both. Back in a minute. And we have a lot more ahead on Face the Nation, including the number two Democrat in the Senate, Dick Durbin, and Senator Kelly Ayotte, who joins us from Kiev. What are their thoughts on the crisis in Ukraine? Stay with us. Some of our stations are leaving us now, but for most of you, we'll be right back with a lot more Face the Nation. Senators Durbin and Ayotte, plus our panel with CBS News foreign correspondent Clarissa Ward, Fortune Magazine's Lee Gallagher, and David Sanger of the New York Times. Stay with us.
And welcome back to Face the Nation. We're going now to Kyiv, Ukraine, where we are joined by Republican Senator Kelly Ayotte, who is leading a congressional delegation to the region. Senator, thank you so much for joining us this morning. There seems to be some sort of demonstration going on behind you right now. You're our reporter on the scene. What's up? What's happening?
In Maidan Square right now, Bob, you see thousands of Ukrainians protesting the Russian occupation of Crimea. So this is a Russian protest by Ukrainians who want their sovereignty, they want their freedom, and they're protesting what Russia did in Crimea.
You are just back, I understand, from a meeting with some of the Ukrainian leaders. What are they telling you about these Russian troops that are poised on the border of Ukraine?
Well, we met with the prime minister. We also met with other ministers of cabinet. And essentially, they're very worried about the Russian amassing of troops on the eastern Ukrainian border. Also yesterday, they arrested three Russian armed agents in eastern Ukraine. And the reason that they are there is to actually create a protest, to actually create a conflict. And so it was good that they arrested them, but you can see the actions that the Russians are trying to take in eastern Ukraine. And so it's so important that we take actions to deter further Russian aggression against the Ukrainian people.
Well, what actually could we do, in your view, Senator?
Having heard here from the leaders, I think I appreciate what the president did this week with sanctions. I think we need to do more with sanctions, including sanctioning the entire financial sectors of the Russian economy, as well as looking at the energy sectors. The Russian economy is a one-trick pony. They're totally focused on natural gas and oil. And so if we were to impose greater sanctions on economic sectors, I think we could have a significant impact on Putin, and then he would get the message. In addition to that, I think further military assistance, the President Yanukovych, the deposed president, essentially he gutted the Ukrainian military, and so I think we could provide some more assistance to them in that regard.
Well, do you think the United States would actually be willing to do that? I mean, they asked for military aid, and we sent them, as I understand it, military meals for the troops. Should we do more? What kind of military aid do you think we ought to send them?
Well, first of all, I think we could do more in terms of communications equipment that we can help them with, technical assistance. In addition to that, they've put in a request to us in NATO for some small arms. I think there's some things that we could do that don't involve our boots on the ground, but really help them also stand up and help their military really at this time. I think that's very important. In addition to that, Bob, you know, we had the USS Truxtun in the Black Sea. Yeah, I think that needs to be returned to the Black Sea. It was on exercises. It's now been removed. I think we should return it there.
The administration had proposed a huge economic package for Ukraine, but the Senate did not seem to see the this was something needed to be done immediately. You all adjourned and went on vacation. Do you think that you'll get around to passing that aid package this week?
As I understand it, we're going to take up that aid package tomorrow in the Senate. I think it's important that we do this right away. Obviously, they need those loan guarantees. They need our assistance. And in addition to the sanctions that the administration has put forward, and I hope that they'll do additional sanctions, this is very important that the Congress do this right away. That was one of the messages that the Prime Minister certainly gave to us today.
Are they worried that in Kyiv that Putin will actually move those troops that are on the border into Ukraine? Is that a worry there now?
I think that's always a consideration and a worry. You see the troops' significant presence he has on the Ukrainian border. You know that the agents, the Russian agents, were arrested yesterday in eastern Ukraine. And that's why it's really important that we turn this around quickly. I think the president has to be appreciate what he's done in terms of sanctions, but to be even stronger. And then also to reassure our allies in the region. Our allies are asking for greater presence of NATO, particularly the Poland, the Czech Republic, those countries surrounding Ukraine. So this is a very important time for the United States, I think, also to help turn this around. It's a wake-up moment in terms of our relationship with Russia. And so we need to deter Putin from further actions because this is a very real threat, Bob.
Could you foresee military forces being put in there, either NATO or U.S. forces or a combination? We are part of NATO, of course.
Of course. I don't see any boots on the ground right now, nor are they asking for that. I think that what we can do, though, is strengthen NATO's presence, particularly in the countries surrounding Ukraine, and also provide assistance to the Ukrainian military. But most importantly, we need to send a message to Vladimir Putin through stronger sanctions. We need him to understand that the sanctions that we put in place can have a significant impact on his economy, that we need to deter further action from him, and understand who he is. Former KGB colonel, he's a bully, and bullies only understand when we punch them in the nose, but we need to do that economically. That is our strongest move at this point.
All right. Well, Senator Ayotte, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much, Bob. Appreciate it.
And we're joined now by the number two Democrat in the Senate, Dick Durbin. He's in Springfield, Illinois this morning. He is recently back from Ukraine. Senator Durbin, let me just start to get your reaction to Mitt Romney earlier today on this broadcast when he suggested that the United States should have been warning Putin much earlier than we did that there would be consequences if he moved into Crimea, and suggested that might have had some impact on what Putin did. Do you agree with that?
Well, Governor Romney had two positions, as I understood him. First, if we'd have shown military force somewhere in the world, it might have discouraged Putin. I disagree, and so does history. In the midst of the Vietnam War, when the United States was deeply involved in that war, Brezhnev invaded Czechoslovakia. In the midst of our wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, Putin invaded the Republic of Georgia. Let's call it for what it is. Here is Vladimir Putin with a failing Soviet franchise. And when he can't win the hearts and minds of his neighboring nations, he uses energy extortion, mass gunmen, and barbed wire. Now, he is a bully, and we've got to call him for what he is. But this notion that some sanction is going to stop a former colonel in the KGB from his ambitions of a Russian empire is naive.
Well, should we have recognized that early on, though?
Well, the fact of the matter is, unilateral sanctions by the United States are good, but not sufficient. What the president has done is first try to negotiate, try to stop the intrigue and the referendum in Crimea. It didn't work, but the good effort was made by Secretary Kerry, by the president, by Angela Merkel, and others. Now the president has announced some sanctions from the United States, and he's headed over to meet with our allies. When we have an effort made at sanctions involving many other nations, it has a potential of greater impact on Russia and discouraging Putin.
One more question about Governor Romney. He says he can't think of a single country in the world where the United States today is held in as high esteem as it was before President Obama became president. What's your response?
Well, Governor Romney's suffering from political amnesia. Does he remember the reaction of the rest of the world to our invasion of Iraq? The fact is that many of our stalwart allies of the past thought it was a terrible decision. What President Obama has done is restore a working relationship. Osama bin Laden is gone. The war in Iraq is over. Afghanistan is coming to a close. And this president has worked with many of these nations successfully to put pressure on Iran with sanctions, bringing them to the negotiating table. I'm afraid Governor Romney's forgotten those facts.
Well, let's talk a little bit about sanctions. The president's imposed some sanctions. Do you think they've had any impact at this point?
Well, they certainly rocked the stock market in Russia for a few days and weeks, and they might continue to. If Vladimir Putin is conscious and aware of his standing in the world economy, he has to understand that this aggression in Crimea is not helping the reputation of Russia as a modern nation where you can do business. He's back to the old Soviet ways, and a lot of folks are going to hold back and pull back as a result of it. I think he may have second thoughts.
The Senate's reaction to all of this was to go on vacation when there was a package of economic aid that the administration wanted to send to the Ukraine. Do you think you're going to be able to take that up now that you're back from vacation?
We'll take that up tomorrow. But for the record, Bob, Majority Leader Harry Reid came to the floor 10 days ago and called the bipartisan measure that passed the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, supported by the Democrats and John McCain and Bob Corker. There was an objection to passing it by a Republican senator on the floor. That's a fact. And now we're hearing the House of Representatives may not take up this effort to protect Ukraine unless we add a provision that will protect the Koch brothers from any investigation by the Treasury Department for misuse of campaign funds. I hope that's not the case.
Well, when Governor Romney talks about how the United States is perceived around the world, how do you think that kind of a situation in the Senate is perceived by other countries?
I think it's awful, and Senator McCain and I agree. We need a bipartisan stance by the Senate and by the House as quickly as possible this week in support of Ukraine, in support of sanctions against Russia, in support of a loan to Ukraine so that they can weather this storm as their economy gets back on its feet. Let's not have political intrigue on Capitol Hill undermining our support and our declaration that we stand behind Ukraine.
Do you think there's going to have to be military aid sent to Ukraine? Should there be? We're sending military food now, meals that we've authorized, but shouldn't it be something more than that, or should it be?
It could be, and I think it should be. John McCain and I sat down, along with six other senators, with their leadership. They're not asking for American troops, nor are we offering them. Kelly was right about that. Senator Ayotte was right about that. But they do need everything from fuel to tires to sleeping bags to meals. This army in Ukraine was devastated by Yanukovych. It is so weak now that there are maybe 6,000 troops ready to go to battle. We've got to strengthen them and help them with advice and backing. And it may come to small arms. I'm not ruling that out. Keep it on the table. For the time being, let's help the Ukrainian army get on its feet as a self-defense force.
All right. Well, Senator, thank you so much for being with us this morning. And we'll be back with our panel in 1 minute. And now for some analysis on all of the above, CBS News foreign correspondent Clarissa Ward, who was just in both Ukraine and Malaysia, and of course before that in Syria, the first reporter to get into Syria, and to give us those dramatic eyewitness reports way back. She's in the studio with us this morning, an unusual place for Clarissa to be. David Sanger is the national security correspondent for the New York Times, and we'd like to welcome Lee Gallagher to the broadcast. She's the assistant managing editor of Fortune magazine. Well, Clarissa, what is your take, and what are you hearing about those Russian troops on the border? Why are they there?
Well, at this stage, I think they're largely there to as a sort of threat, in a sense, a show of force and a threat that at any point in time, when Putin decides that Russian troops could go in with very little resistance and take eastern Ukraine as well as Crimea region, which they've already taken over in, 3 weeks flat. So I think it's more of a threat than it is an actual sort of declaration of an imminent invasion. But I do think that when we're looking at Putin's actions here, we really need to look further into what his point is, because I think there's a misconception that this is kind of reigniting the Cold War and Putin's a bully and he's just, sort of lashing out at Ukraine, when actually I think that this goes much deeper to that. There is actually a perception in Russia that Russia has been the victim for 25 years, that they have suffered enormous humiliation at the hands of the West, and that they have not been allowed to maintain this sphere of influence, that they have seen EU and NATO expansion into Lithuania, into Poland. They've seen U.S. military bases opening in Kyrgyzstan, all parts of the former sort of Soviet empire. So there's a real sense with Ukraine that is somehow just crossing a line that cannot be crossed. As Putin described, Kiev is the mother of Russian cities. These Russian people view Ukraine as an extension of Russia. And so there's a sense that Putin really will do whatever it takes, even in the face of overwhelming diplomatic and economic pressure, to defend what he sees as Russia's vital interests. And I think when we're trying to understand what's going on in Ukraine, we have to keep that in mind. This isn't a simple case of Putin agitating for a fight.
Well, one of the things that I've learned, maybe everybody in the world knew it but me, when all of this happened, was that in the days before the Tsars, Kiev was actually the capital.
Absolutely. It's
Russia.
Ancient Rus. Yes.
Yes. Lee, we're talking about these sanctions and their impact on the Russian economy. What do you think? Will they have an impact?
I think they have had an impact already. The first round earlier this week was largely symbolic, but the second round that we saw Thursday started to have an impact and have a bite pretty immediately. A couple examples of that are the bank Russia, which was sanctioned, the only bank itself to be sanctioned. Well, that's where Putin has his money. He can move his money, but MasterCard and Visa immediately stopped doing business and processing the transactions of that bank's clients. That has an immediate impact on the ground with consumers, ATM transactions, businesses, immediate. And they didn't give any warning. Another example of that would be Gennady Timchenko, who was sanctioned. He owns a company called Gunvor, which is a Swiss-based commodity trading company. Billions of contracts and billions of dollars worth of contracts were processed through that. And he had sold his stake the day before the sanction, but companies all over the world, some of the largest publicly traded companies, are looking at that company with a little bit more trepidation and angst. And I think the threat of more sanctions casts a pall on anything. The money that's moving out of Russia right now is significant. And I think that just the threat sort of amplifies the impact of the sanctions.
What is the shape of Russia's economy right now?
It's, you know, this is a narrative that I think has been lost. It's sort of flown under the radar, but the Russian economy is in crisis mode now. It was in crisis mode before the word Crimea became a household name. Last year, growth slowed rather suddenly. The ruble fell, the consumer spending fell off, exports fell. It's in a bad place. And now, after the crisis, the stock has fallen more, the ruble's fallen more. S&P and Fitch Ratings have downgraded Russia's credit rating outlook, and, you know, this impacts any foreign investment that is going to think about touching Russia is thinking twice. Every risk officer at every corporation is being asked, what's your exposure to Russia?
What do you think the impact of this is, David? And what else can the United States do? I mean, what, for example, if Putin does decide to move into eastern Ukraine?
Well, Bob, I think that's exactly why you've seen the president hold back some sanctions, because he needs a second round, a much bigger round. And I agree with Lee that the psychological impact of these sanctions that he's announced already has been important. But we learned something in the years in which both the Bush administration and then the Obama administration sanctioned Iran. And that is that the Bush had sanctions on Iran that weren't terribly effective. They only actually brought the Iranians to the negotiating table when they got to the core part of their economy, which, of course, was also oil and gas. And that's what President Obama is holding in reserve here if Putin goes into to the eastern part of Ukraine. The question is, will the Europeans go with him? And, you know, here the interesting issue is that President Obama has actually been out ahead of his European allies, including Chancellor Merkel in Germany. And when Vice President Biden went on his trip this week to try to shore up some of the allies and give them reassurance the U.S. was with them, the message he got back was, well, we thank you for showing up. We're with you on sanctions, unless, of course, Putin starts turning off our gas. And they're way too overdependent on Russian gas. So President Obama doesn't want to go there. Putin probably doesn't want to go there. The big question comes back to what Clarissa said before about what Putin's real intentions are here, because he does believe that he has a historic responsibility to restore at least some Russian pride, if not the old Soviet empire, and I don't think he's trying to go back to the full part of the empire. But at the same time, I'm not sure he's as sensitive to sanctions as we would all like to think.
Absolutely. And that, you know, when you look at his approval ratings, they're sky high at the moment. The economic sanctions are absolutely going to hurt Russia's economy. They're hurting some of his key inner sanctum, but they are not affecting his political standing. And it's hard to see how they would do so, at least in the short term.
You know, a year from now might be a different picture.
A year from now might be. But right now, I think people do forget there is still a lot of nostalgia in Russia for the Soviet Union. There is this kind of utopian sort of misconception of what it was, and that they look at it through the vision of these 1960s and 70s sort of technicolor Soviet musical comedies that they all love to watch. And so obviously they're looking at it with rose-tinted glasses, but there's definitely a sense that people are tired of the humiliation, that they don't want to be perceived as weak within the international community. And they are therefore actually quite grateful to President Putin for reinstating some sense of national pride.
I want to shift just a bit because, Lee, your magazine had a very interesting story. You picked the top 50 greatest leaders in the world today, I noticed Derek Jeter of the New York Yankees, the shortstop, managed to make the list. I noticed that Barack Obama did not make the list. Also, nor did Vladimir Putin. How did you come up with this list?
Well, we were really, this is a new list for us, and we really looked at leadership from a, we looked at leadership this year. We looked for people, leaders who really changed a paradigm, who really disrupted, led in a way that just changed the game. And we looked at a number of exceptional leaders. So just because someone is not on this list does not mean we're saying they're not a good leader. But, you know, we really looked at real game changers. And there's only one sitting
in their specific area.
In their sphere, in their endeavor, in their area of a sphere of influence, exactly. And there's only one sitting head of state on this list, and that's Angela Merkel, who is going to play a critical role going forward. I do think that if Europe can partner with us and, you know, issue sanctions that are stronger than what it's done already, I think that that could be a real game-changing example of leadership. But it runs the gamut. You know, we have Angelina Jolie, we have the Dalai Lama, so there's a lot.
And, David, you have a big story in the paper today about the National Security Agency. Give us a little brief on that.
Well, there's a company, Bob, a Chinese company called Huawei that the United States has long been concerned about. They sell networking equipment, and they've been trying to sell in the United States for years, and they've been blocked by the past two administrations from selling most of their equipment because of the fear that once they got into the U.S., it could be a conduit for the Chinese, the People's Liberation Army, to get into the networks. What we told readers this morning was that the National Security Agency has been inside Huawei's networks now for several years, trying to figure out whether or not they are a PLA front, but also trying to find out whether or not they could use Huawei's networks when they're bought by countries that don't want to buy American equipment, presumably because they think the NSA is in that equipment, so that we can get into Kenya and Cuba and many other Huawei customers. So it does give you a sense that this cyber war that's been underway between China and the United States is really a two-way war, and it's really accelerating.
Well, I want to thank all of you for being with us this morning. A fascinating discussion. It's no loss of things to talk about in the world today. So thank you all for being with us, and we'll be back in just a minute. Well, that is it for us today, so we hope you'll tune in to CBS This Morning tomorrow for the latest on all of these major stories. As for us, we'll be back next week with another Face the Nation.
This has been Face the Nation with CBS News Chief Washington Correspondent Bob Schieffer. Today's guests were 2012 Republican presidential nominee Mitt Romney and Senators Kelly Ayotte and Richard Durbin. The executive producer of Face the Nation is Mary Hager. The senior producer is Rob Hendon, and the producer is Emily Bradley. This broadcast was directed by Sue Ann Stockey-Wayne from CBS News in Washington. For more Face the Nation, we're online at facethenation.com. And you can follow Face the Nation, Bob Schieffer, and CBS Radio News on Twitter, Google+, and Facebook.